Thank you, distinguished guests. I came to this paper with a desire to explore some of the problems of authorship faced by creative people in situations of compromise, negotiation, or contract. It seems to me that creativity in these situations is poorly served by the model of the romantic author, who has a singular creative inspiration that rises above craft or technical knowledge. Their work may instead involve other measures of excellence, including, for example, use in design or perhaps character or biography in photography. And it's for this reason I became very interested in the series of portraits by Anglo-Greek photographer Platon Antoniou, made for the New Yorker magazine in 2009, 50 portraits of world leaders during a meeting of the United Nations General Assembly. Now, political portraiture is a genre reaching back as far as the daguerreotype process of the 1840s and 1850s, with some of the best known being that of Abraham Lincoln and Daniel Webster. Like these famous portraits, Antoniou's images appear full of character, and he outwardly fulfills the portraitist's role, it seems, in engaging with the viewer in an illustration of psychological depth. And yet I was surprised at the manner in which Antoniou evacuates or empties out meaning in his commentaries over the images, the interactive display. For example, Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's is a performance for the camera made seemingly in spite of, rather than in concert with, the creative will of the portraitist. At best, there is no sense of Antoniou's getting to the real person. At worst, it resembles what Richard Brilliant suggests is the portrait as a battlefield, documenting the struggle for dominance between the artist's conception and the sitter's will. In my paper, I explore what I call the portraitist's dilemma, which is particularly visible in this series, and which I think accounts for Antoniou's awkward commentary. I see it as a particularly Platonic dilemma because of the situation it places the photographer with regard to his or her relation to craft, truth, and the real, which is possibly character, possibly something else. This precarious situation refers, of course, to Socrates' dialogue in The Republic and his accusation of anyone engaged in representation as being a long way removed from the truth. After all, he suggests, if such a person really knew about things he represented, he would devote himself to them entirely and not to their representations. Now, I boast most of my approach on the 10th book of Republic and on many of the modern interpretations that surround this and other possibly other instances where I think where Plato's approach to craft, imitation, and possibly art is detected. I'm not a classicist nor a Hellenist, and so I'm in your hands in much of my reading of Plato and the differing interpretations of his approach to mimesis and especially techne. I come to this paper from a distinct tradition of critical art history, one that is taught in art schools directly to students who will be artists and designers as opposed to art historians. I found that it was actually not unexpected for a photographer to reject the possibility of portraits being able to reveal psychological depth. This has a lot to do, I think, with what Max Kozloff has described as the portraitist's unusual position in relation to their subject, part of their own culture, but distanced from it, and he suggests this in the work of Diane Arbus. Perhaps the most famous example in recent years is of a photographer openly rejecting psychological depth is that of the German artist Thomas Ruff, who takes a confrontational approach to the process of photography, such as through very large-scale printing so that every facial blemish is visible, or else masked through the use of soft focus. He trained as a photographer under the great partnership of Berndt and Hella Becker, and Ruff's approach appears to be greatly influenced by their photographs of industrial architecture. The Becker photographs reach something close to an illustration of Platonic ideal forms, in that differences between examples, often very few and very subtle, seem to present them as imperfect copies of a constant ideal. I want to explore, however, the sense of distance from the practice of portraiture a little further by looking at a photograph by Walker Evans. Evans became one of the leading figures in American photography in the 1930s, during the period of the New Deal, traveling across the southern United States. Whilst on assignment, he photographed this window display of a local portrait photographer in Savannah, Georgia. The official verdict from the Museum of Modern Art is that it represents Evans' affinity with the plain-spoken vernacular of ordinary photographers. However, Brilliant, again, detects a pernicious animosity. And yet Alan Trachtenberg has observed that this dissociation of the artist as photographer from the portrait as a carrier of meaning was also part of a theoretical turn as well as a move in practice. And they come together in the work of artists such as Cindy Sherman. Sherman's work serves to recapitulate or dismantle the codes of advertising, commercial photography, and pornography and relay them back to us. She has often refused to engage in any psychological or critical subtext to her staged self-portraits, and yet she still has invested them in a studied performance. In this series, for instance, she also addresses the small town studio portrait, playing off the surface masquerade constructed from hair dye, fake tan, and cosmetic surgery. The prospective characters, not hers. A key signifier in these works is the use of the monotone background, which concentrates significance onto the face. Yet at the same time, the independent identity of the subject can seem barely contained. Albrecht Dürer's portrait of Philip Melanchthon is suggestive of a great intelligence, but also the theological premise of the mind's proximity to God. This is inherited by some of Nadar's most famous portraits, which strip the environment bare in order to focus attention on the creative mind revealed in the face. It's also an inheritance seen in Richard Avedon's work, especially his project in the American West. Yet this is more striking still, since Avedon too is famous for disavowing the ability of photography to produce anything more than surface appearances. Now, the use of white background in Antonio's work made me look again at Lorenzo Lotto's 1508 painting, Man Before a White Curtain. It has a particularly stark composition for its time, and a particular disposition of the portrait's elements, the curtain both veils and reveals, which has led Norbert Schneider to talk of it in terms of the birth of the psychological portrait. Strangely, it reminds me a lot of the modern passport photograph and what the state portrait tells us about signification in the genre more widely. Spectacles, for example, are now assumed to cover or hide our real face, the face that provides legal, biological, or social information for use by the state. But I find the removal of the curtain in this sequence more interesting, since it suggests that it is hiding or veiling something, even though it is behind the sitter. The white background now appears to guarantee access to the real in photography, as if to say there is no deceit here, no attempt to conceal, everything to be read is legible in the face. We might think about how, for example, the white background is used in fashion and advertising to suggest notions of the clinical or the specimen. And I think for Antonio, it is a void that is instrumental in reaching the person behind the politician. The style that Antonio has developed in the Portraits of Power series and in much of his previous work is significant because of the disposition of the background, either through the use of bleached out white or the vignette that we see in one of his most famous images, the 2000 portrait of US President Bill Clinton. Now, in the long version of the paper, I describe him as this: his hands resting on his knees, looking down at the camera, whilst the end of his sky blue tie rests libidinously on his crotch. Can I use the word libidinously in this context? Would you know what I mean if I did? If so, it's probably because of a mixture of biographical information you may have of Clinton and your particular relationship to him as president, one that is based on consequentiality, a cognitive term. The actions of the leader of the free world had and still have consequences for us, so we will read into and read out of the image accordingly. To shoot a political portrait is to do so in the knowledge that the portrait will signify specific things for any viewer who has knowledge of the subject, inviting an emphasis on biography. Knowing that his portraits will undoubtedly be made intelligible by interested viewers based on the principle of consequentiality may account to some extent for Antonio's stepping back from biographical detail. He may know very well, for example, about the life of and impact of Evo Morales, Gordon Brown, Robert Mugabe, or Muammar al-Gaddafi, but feels he need do no more than relay his encounter to the knowledgeable viewer. So the encounter with Gaddafi in the commentaries yields a story of the intimidating circumstances. His encounter with Morales leaves Antonio speechless, and he renders him as an exotic other. Whilst he focuses on Mugabe's skin as shiny or waxy, metonymic of nefarious and unseen acts and deeds. The commentary on Irish Taoiseach Brian Cowan is by reverse illustration of the roles of both photographer and politician as willful estrangers who meet by circumstance. I know nothing about his life, Antonio says. He knows nothing about mine, and yet there is an intimacy between us. It was whilst looking at Cowan's portrait that I was reminded of Chuck Close, and in particular, his self-portrait of 1968. Close's photomechanical approach involves scaling up a photograph to an immense size and transferring it to canvas by hand. For the philosopher Kendall Walton, the portrait looks like a photograph, but when its true nature is revealed, we feel somehow less in contact with Close. This, I think, reveals the expectation we have of the photograph being akin to the Akira poetic image, the direct action of God channeled through the artist and their production, the icon, for example. This brings me to my summing up and my approach to Antonio's awkward platonic dilemma. Ultimately, I ask the following question of the photographic portraitist. Does the photographer produce a portrait as an Akira poetic imitation of the sitter, here a politician, at the expense of their intermediary role as an artist? Or does the photographer offer a portrait from a particular point of view and thus provide a deceptive imitation that provides little other than surface information, as we see in Avedon and Thomas Roof? My initial exploration, and the paper is representative of exactly that, an initial exploration, I found myself working with different accounts of creativity in Plato, which may actually be at the root of the dilemma, since they present the photographer with a curious identity. And here, I just now want to pick out the problem of the poet and the muse, and also the issue of techne. The first account is that of the romantic author as subject to divine inspiration. For some, like Eva Schaper, Plato sets up a significant tension among three distinct roles for the poet, which have been drawn out by scholars ever since. Either the poet is in a fugue-like state from which images emanate Akira poetically, or the poet is knowingly able to produce emotions which are without true knowledge and are thus wholly deceptive. Or, and perhaps this is the most attractive in the visual arts, the poet is especially sensitive to feeling and emotion as truth. And it's this idea of the winged thing from Eon, harvesting fruit from the garden of the muse, pollinating as it goes. So any adoption of the identity of the romantic author is problematic even from this start. In a similar vein, Monroe Beardsley's account from the 60s of mimesis reminds us of the politician's role in representing the people's will. The politician is already engaged in mimesis, on the one hand in terms of performance, and in another in terms of statecraft as a techne. It is techne which forms the second account of creativity that I've started to work with, and I think it may show us a way to understand the value of creative production in photography in terms of use. In this sense, I was impressed by Suzanne Stern-Gillett's justification model for techne that employs as a guiding principle its relationship to function or use as the ideal form. And justification model is actually a term that I'm bringing from project management. Some of you may know that. Photography can be imparted by teaching, for example. It can give a rational account of its manufacture, and it generally corresponds to its subject matter. It would be an unusual portrait which was not concerned in some way with the good of its object or recipient, or which did not pass on some form of knowledge about the sitter. But what interests me most is the relationship she draws out between techne and truth. For our analysis, I think, this ultimately has a lot to do with Antonio's position, working for a political journal making portraits of politicians. He is employed for his distinctive style, and because he achieves a level of excellence in producing a specific type of image. The disposition of his images, such as the extreme close-up and the white background, are part of a communicative design rather than an imitative art. Photography for commercial purposes is then, I think, closer to techne as craft rather than as art, as we would use the term. But this is nonetheless a practice involving excellence and access to truth. The final question then is what truth is being accessed, and I think this rather depends on what kind of knowledge we imagine a political portraitist to have. Why, finally, should Antonio engage in biographical statements in his commentaries at all, since his knowledge is not specifically about politics and does not need to be? We might say, because of his situation vis-à-vis the magazine, that his knowledge is that of presentation and performance, and his particular craft is the production of the political portrait. This sometimes presents him with encounters in which he is unhappily complicit in the production of political identity. Perhaps it is for this reason that his commentaries on Berlusconi and Mugabe demonstrate a flinching or squinting in the face of a political presence and suggest something more telling of the relationship between portraitist and sitter. The portraitist is not a link in the chain to the muse, nor produces Akira poetic images of a subject that reveals itself. He is actually a partner in the politician's craft of representation. This is the truth of the photographer's political portrait, but it is a truth that may be impossible to bear. Thank you very much.